This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. A rocket attack in a southern Yemeni separatist militia graduation ceremony has left at least 10 people dead and more than several dozen wounded. A spokesman for the militia, which is aligned with the Saudi coalition, now claiming that Yemen's Iranian-backed Houthis were behind that attack. Ukrainian authorities and Russia-backed separatists in eastern Ukraine have concluded a prisoner swap. And that's according to the office of Ukraine's president on Sunday. We get more from VOA's Zlatis Ahok.
Survivors helped victims of the rocket attack as rescue workers evacuated the wounded to ambulances, taking them to hospitals in the southern Yemeni capital of Aden. Witnesses say the rocket struck near a viewing stand at a military graduation ceremony for southern separatist militia cadets. Yemen southern separatists targeted in Sunday's attack have been fighting the Houthis alongside other forces loyal to President Hadi. The separatists, who are seeking independence from southern Yemen, clashed with other forces loyal to Hadi in Aden this past summer. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
The Taliban's ruling council agreed Sunday to a temporary ceasefire in Afghanistan, providing a window in which a peace agreement with the United States can be signed. That's according to officials from the insurgent group. A ceasefire had been demanded by Washington before any peace agreement could be signed. Find more at voanews.com. This is VOA News. The White House says that it would consider other tools beyond diplomacy if North Korea reignites tensions over its nuclear program by going ahead with the threatened Christmas gift. Pyongyang has imposed an end-of-year deadline for the United States to soften its stance on nuclear talks that have been stalled since February. VOA's Arash Arabasadi reports.
It was not the first prisoner exchange involving Russia.
Sunday, National Security Advisor Ambassador Robert O'Brien lauded the president's personal diplomacy with Kim. But O'Brien's predecessor, John Bolton, is among those saying there is no chance the North denuclearizes. No doubt a strain to the on-again, off-again diplomatic love affair between Trump and Kim. O'Brien says the president gave Pyongyang options throughout his administration's talks with the North.
He's got two paths in front of him. He's got a glorious path for the people of North Korea, where they could become like South Korea and be a very prosperous, very wealthy country. Or there's another path that takes him down the road of sanctions and isolation and being a pariah state.
North Korea has conducted 13 rounds of short-range ballistic missile and rocket artillery tests in 2019. Trump has downplayed those tests as unimportant. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
The suspect who allegedly stabbed five Hasidic Jews during Hanukkah celebrations near New York City Saturday pleaded not guilty in his first court appearance. Grafton Thomas was charged with five counts of attempted murder, one count of burglary. He made no comment during his arraignment Sunday. A judge set bail at $5 million, and Grafton remains in jail. Grafton allegedly burst into the home of the rabbi a Saturday night, where he then was hosting 70 people celebrating the seventh night of the Jewish festival of Hanukkah. The Saturday night attack took place in a New York suburb home to a large Orthodox Jew community. U.S. Representative John Lewis, who has served more than three decades in Congress, has announced that he has cancer. And Hong Kong will end 2019 with multiple protests planned for New Year's Eve and New Year's Day, aimed at disrupting festivities and the shopping in the Asian financial hub, which has seen a rise in clashes between police and protesters since Christmas. Events dubbed Suck the Eve and Shop with You are scheduled for New Year's Eve on Tuesday around the city. A New Year's Day march on January 1st has been given police a permission and will start from a large park in bustling Causeway Bay. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Paul Alexander in Washington, sitting in for James Buddy. Today is Monday, December 30th, and here are some of the stories we're covering. Somalia's capital is coping with a truck bomb blast that killed at least 90 people and wounded 125. Guinea-Bissau holds a presidential runoff election, and Liberia's capital is tense as it braces for a protest. We'll also hear about Turkey planning to send forces to support the UN-backed government in Tripoli, and we'll have the final part of Darren Taylor's five-part series on China's growing role in Africa.
Whilst African leaders feel that they get a certain level of respect from China that they don't get from the West, there's no free lunch, and if they're unable to service their debt obligations, there will be consequences which could potentially undermine their sovereignty.
That was South African risk analyst Ronak Gopaldas. Those stories, plus Samson O'Malley's sports, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Doctors and medical supplies came in while seriously wounded victims were airlifted out as Somalia's stunned capital dealt with the aftermath of a truck bomb attack that killed at least 90 people and injured another 125. The truck had been blocked from entering Mogadishu at a checkpoint where nearly 100 vehicles and rickshaws carrying passengers waited for routine security inspections Saturday morning. It exploded next to a minibus packed with university students who represented the battered country's future. There was no claim of responsibility, but the attack bore the hallmarks of the Al-Shabaab Islamist group that has carried out similar bombings. At least 16 of the most severely wounded people, including small children, have been airlifted to Turkey for treatment. At least 16 of the most severely wounded people, including small children, have been airlifted to Turkey for treatment, and another plane was expected to take more to Qatar. Mogadishu health officials have issued a plea for blood donations. Tensions have been building up in the Liberian capital ahead of a planned protest today by a group called Council of Patriots that says it wants answers from President George Weah on issues of governance, corruption, and the economy. The government has denied a permit and request for security protection from the group that is headed by controversial talk show host and politician Henry Costa. But the group says it will go ahead anyway. A breakaway faction, the Independent Council of Patriots, says it has called off a counter-protest at the government's request. Moses Garziawu reports from Monrovia.
Tensions started growing last weekend in the capital between the supporters of the rival groups. A statement signed by Justice Minister Frank Musa Dean says government cannot grant the two groups' request for simultaneous protests because it wants to safeguard the country's peace and security. Henry Costa, the leader of the Council of Patriots, said they have not been notified by the government that their request has been denied.
That communication has not been received. The mode of communication between ourselves and the government has been through writing, and we have not been communicated with officially, so we do not know. The Minister of Justice, in the presence of the international community, the United Nations, ECOWAS, and President of the Interreligious Council, made a commitment to provide us security protection for our peaceful assembly.
Costa says they would not leave the streets until they receive answers from Weah on a wide range of national issues, ranging from governance to corruption to economic stagnation.
Action on the state of the economy, the worsening political situation in the country, and the increasing divisiveness, which has been driven by the president, the issue of the $25 million, and a whole wide range of things which border on integrity, accountability, transparency, and corruption.
We have recently told national radio that granting people's desire to protest must be done in the confines of the law through the Justice Ministry.
The message to my people, we have to be peaceful. If you are granted permit to protest, if you do it in a peaceful way, they allow you. So the Justice Minister has the power to make sure that those people that want to protest go through the actual framework of securing a ground to protest.
Former Representative Rufus Nouvelle of the Independent Council of Patriots said he was disappointed with the Justice Ministry decision not to issue a permit to his side, but we accept it.
In spite of our disappointment and frustration in this letter, we can do no more than accept the letter from the government of Liberia that we should not counter protest. The RCOP is not a rebel group. We cannot defy the government. We cannot disobey the advice from the international community calling for peace and tranquility.
Police spokesman Moses Carter told the VOA that police would not tolerate lawlessness or efforts to impede the free movement of people.
We have what we call non-lethal approach. That is, we're not going to use firearm. If the need be to use it, obviously it will be used.
Talks brokered by the United Nations Mission in West Africa and ECOWAS have failed to stop the protest. The embassies of several countries in the European Union have expressed concerns about the protest jeopardizing a hard-won peace after 14 years of civil crisis. Moses Gazeu, VOA News, Monrovia.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm Paul Alexander in Washington, and today is Monday, December 30th. The release of journalist and activist Omoyele Sowore from a Nigerian prison last week has triggered negative reactions from media freedom advocates in the country. They say the action has done no good. Timothy Obiezu in Abuja reports Omoyele's arrest attracted global attention to Nigeria's poor record on press freedom.
Supporters and journalists chattered in excitement at Department of State Security headquarters in Abuja as a vehicle carrying Omoyele Sowore approached. He stepped out and reacted to his Christmas Eve release after being held since August, despite two court orders calling for his immediate freedom.
Only thing is to thank Nigerians. Yes. They made this happen, yes, and they should not relent. Nobody can take a people who are determined for granted.
The journalist was arrested days ahead of a nationwide protest against what the government called Revolution Now. Overruling a court decision has become very common in Nigeria, although authorities say the decision to release the news reporter was intended to set a good example of compliance with the law. Critics, however, fault the government for attaching restrictions to the release, including a travel ban and limits on public association. Marshall Abubakar is a human rights lawyer.
The release is not a win. As a matter of fact, I think it's still a loss for Nigeria. What I expected to hear, because Mr. Abubakar Malami, the AGF, made a statement that he has taken over the case of Mr. Omoyele Sowore. We've always insisted that the charges in the first place should not even be.
Critics consider Sowore's arrest and detention an effort by the Nigerian government to censor the press and clamp down on free opinion. Although authorities deny the accusation, President Muhammadu Buhari's media aide, Garba Shehu, says in a statement that Sowore's affront on the government comes from an advantaged position as a journalist and publisher of the New York-based online news organization, Sahara Reporters. A coalition endorsing the protection of whistleblowers and press freedom in Nigeria says the country recorded more than 70 attacks on journalists and the media this year alone. An incident Monday, barely 24 hours before Sowore's release, resulted in injuries to protesters and journalists. The leader of the protest, Deji Adeyanju, was badly beaten, allegedly by government thugs, and is being treated in Dubai. Human rights activist Adebayo Raphael was among protesters at the Monday incident.
It is important that this kind of repressive environment is not allowed to thrive. You would know that in the last 4 years, human rights and rule of law have been seriously battered in Nigeria.
Human rights lawyer Abubakar accuses the government of trying to hide its shortcomings.
It's a calculated attempt by the government to gag the media, to ensure that people do not expose their inadequacies, that people do not expose their incompetence, that people do not express dissent. We all cannot have the same opinion on issues. We all cannot agree at all times on all things.
In 2015, Nigerian authorities used a cybercrimes law to justify the arrest of bloggers and journalists. Lawmakers are considering two bills to regulate free speech on the internet and social media. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
Libya's internationally recognized government has formally requested that Turkey provide air, ground, and sea military support to fend off an offensive of eastern forces to take the capital, Tripoli. Turkey's President Tayyip Erdogan said his country will send troops to Libya as soon as its parliament approves. They will support the government of national accord, which is backed by the United Nations. Forces led by General Khalifa Haftar have besieged Tripoli for months, trying to capture it and take control of the country. U.S. President Donald Trump and Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi agreed in a phone call on Thursday that they reject foreign exploitation in Libya and urge parties to the conflict to take urgent steps to resolve the fighting. VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shanawi discussed these developments with Jason Pack, a non-resident fellow at the Middle East Institute.
Well, this move is quite serious. It's been brewing for a long time, since the November 27th announcement of the Turkey-Libya MOUs, one about a maritime exclusive economic zone, and then this about defense cooperation. Essentially, what has happened is, since General Haftar and his so-called Libyan National Army have attacked Tripoli in April, they have received more and more foreign support from Russia, Egypt, Saudi, Jordan, and to some extent France. And none of the major Western powers who support the General National Accord government in Tripoli have been willing to provide that defensive support. Only Turkey is willing to backstop the GNA government. And as a result, the more outside support Haftar has, Prime Minister Sarraj and the GNA need to rely on Turkey to prevent the collapse of Tripoli and the fall of their government.
U.S. President Donald Trump and Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi agreed in a phone call yesterday that they reject foreign exploitation in Libya and urged parties to the conflict to take urgent steps to stop the fighting. What do you make of that when Egypt is backing one side of the Libyan conflict and calling for lifting UN embargo on arms to the National Libyan Army?
Egypt and the UAE outwardly support the UN process, but in reality, they give arms and support to General Haftar. However, their role is more sophisticated in that the Egyptians in particular wish to dominate the Libya file, and that requires mediation between both sides. And they wish to frame the Turks as aggressors for deploying troops in essentially what is a defensive position. So it's convenient for them to say publicly, we're calling for all outside intervention to cease. Making the other side look like they're the ones who are intervening is convenient for public relations purposes. But what has happened is essentially only Turkey now is debating formally sending its official army, whereas the Egyptians have trainers and the UAE pay money for mercenaries and the Russians send mercenaries. The Turks would be the first who are openly violating the arms embargo by sending their formal army.
Al-Mahdi Al-Majrabi, representative of the Libyan delegation to the UN, criticized in a letter to the Security Council Egypt's rejection of the two deals signed between the GNA and Turkey, which has granted Ankara a green light for military intervention in Libya. Could that lead eventually to a military confrontation in Libya between Turkey and Egypt?
I could see, in fact, that it could do the opposite. So long as those supporting Haftar feel the more mercenaries they send or the more drones, there won't be any pushback. That promotes that intervention. However, if Turkish troops, formal army troops, are sent to Tripoli, that could act as a tripwire, because neither Egypt nor Russia will want to have on their hands the killing of any Turkish troops, because that could present a regional escalation. I could see this reality where putting Turkish troops in Tripoli acts as a backstop and a tripwire and prevents the advance of other outside actors and could actually be a positive step to allow horse trading at the international level at various summits and private phone calls between leaders.
Algerian president has chaired a rare meeting of the High Security Council to discuss contingency plan for Turkish military intervention in Libya. What does that mean?
Essentially, those neutral powers in northwestern Africa, Algeria, Tunis, Morocco, do not want to see the collapse of the Tripoli government. They're not willing to, for a whole range of reasons, give their own military support, but they would be happy for the Turks to backstop the GNA, just as I believe fundamentally the U.S., the U.K., and Italy would be as well. So no doubt they're doing contingency planning. Hey, maybe the Turks are going to do this heavy lifting for us and prevent the collapse of the GNA and total chaos in Libya, which is what would happen if Haftar took the capital. So it makes sense that various powers, both in northwestern Africa and in Europe and America, are working with the Turks to make sure that this step is implemented in a way that it's not seen as an intervention, but a defensive tripwire.
That was Jason Pack with the Middle East Institute speaking with VOA's Mohammed El-Shanawi. The public debt of most African countries is growing rapidly. This coincides with the emergence of China as the biggest financial backer of African infrastructure projects, such as Kenya's new railway. China has replaced the West as the continent's primary creditor. Many economists say the debt is unsustainable and, in some cases, impossible for some countries to ever pay. Today, in the last part of our look at China's growing presence in Africa, VOA's Darren Taylor in Johannesburg looks at its role in the ballooning debts of some countries.
Africa owes China tens of billions of dollars, and the numbers are swelling by the second. Kenya, for example, has a public debt of about $60 billion. Much of it's owed to China for the construction of several infrastructure projects. Kenyan development economist Anzetse Were says African states find Chinese loans attractive, primarily because Beijing doesn't dictate terms for a project and lecture about human rights or good governance, as many Western lenders do.
When you deal with European and North American governments, they have a very clear idea of how they think development should happen. It's sort of this feeling that if you use our money, we want you to do it this way. African governments have really become quite tired of that.
She says China's own dramatic economic growth adds incentive to borrowers in Africa. Were says China's rise tells African governments that the path to economic progress isn't all about free markets and democracy, which the West emphasizes. South African risk analyst Ronak Gopaldas warns against what he calls the myth that borrowing from China is easy, even though its loans involve less stringent conditions.
Whilst African leaders feel that they get a certain level of respect from China that they don't get from the West, there's no free lunch. And if they're unable to service their debt obligations, there will be consequences which could potentially undermine their sovereignty.
In Zambia, China has lent heavily for airport and power projects, and there are concerns those assets could come under Chinese control as the Lusaka government struggles to pay its debts. There's also growing concern on the continent and in the West that China will soon control much of tiny Djibouti, where Beijing has lent funds for ports and pipelines.
Djibouti's geostrategic position is very, very important. There's huge contestation amongst global partners around having a naval and military base there. It straddles the Indian Ocean, the Red Sea. It's very important to China. It's very important to European powers. It's very important to the Arab world as well, just given...
Djibouti has access to the Suez Canal, the shortest trade route between East and West. Gopaldas says if the West loses even partial access to the canal, it would suffer immense economic damage. He adds that Beijing's choice of Djibouti as the site for its first overseas military base says everything about China's future designs in the region. Were, however, says the view that China is somehow tricking Africa into debt infantilizes African leaders and absolves them of responsibility by underestimating their decision-making power.
The debt trap narrative makes Africa the passive player that's being acted upon, that is helpless, and there's this monstrous power that's coming in and taking advantage. But it really prevents the real issue, which is the accountability of our government in terms of how they use our public finances, how they use our taxes, and the debt that they get into.
Ultimately, says Were, the Chinese government cannot be blamed for the failure of some African administrations to manage their debts. She adds that African countries must improve their ability to sign good deals. Were says this requires employing skilled financial experts to use Chinese loans in the best ways possible, which also minimizes the chances of corruption and mismanagement. Gopaldas agrees that African nations must play the economic diplomacy game better so that they take advantage of foreign powers' growing desire to have greater presence on the continent.
Are they putting all their eggs in the China basket, or are they kind of looking strategically at alternative partners as well? Because the Indians and the Japanese are also kind of very interested in expanding their influence in the Indian Ocean. The Russians are looking to invest and be a key partner in Africa again.
He says African policymakers must begin to embrace the fact that China isn't the only game in town. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here's Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you, Paul. We begin the sport results from March 8th of the 2019-2020 competition of African football champions in South Africa. Mamelodi Sundowns took some control with a 1-0 triumph over host AFM Alger at the Stade Mustapha Tuta Stadium in Binga. The victory sees the South African side move to 7 points from a possible 9 at the top of the log on their way to qualification for the last game. The other critical game later in Morocco, the other Casablanca cut Sundowns lead back down to 2 points with a 4-1 thrashing of Angola's Pepe Luanda, inspired by a hot streak from Ayub Elkaidi. In Group B, there is now a 3-way tie at the top of the log. After wins for Al Hilal and Al Hilal, the major Sudanese side claimed a surprise 1-0 away win triumph over the Cape of Sahel in late, thanks to a second half goal from Alka El Tahir to join the Tunisians from 6 points in an early evening game. The ninth game at the Al Salam Stadium in Cairo, when we saw the two Egyptian side Al Ahly defeat Zimbabwe's FC Platinum 2-0 with attacker Yanis Selimane scoring both goals for the Red Devils to see them turn their toll and Hilal on half a dozen points. In other matches, like in Angola, Zambia with a 1-1 draw between host Desker United and Egyptian giant Zamalek. The White Knights led to Mustafa Mohamed, that was kept back by Tunisia and Pico Pedri at Kiboki. The result means DR Congo Heavyweights keeping Mozambique top group A with 7 points, 3 ahead of second place Zamalek, while Zesco has drawn level with Angola's Pinedo Augusto on 2 points apiece. In Ghana, after 1 year's break, the Ghana Premier League made a return this weekend, throwing up some interesting results across the match venue. The top flight had been away through the suspension of the 2017-2018 championship halfway through the season and subsequently annulled due to a bribery and match-fixing scandal. The comeback of the level of the league ends an 18-month absence. Also, all Nigeria seasons, the new campaign now features 18 teams. In rugby news, South Africa stretched to a 107-1 victory over England on the first day of the first test at Centurion Park on Sunday after taking 7 wickets in the second session to go ahead in the first four-match series. Cricket South Africa versus England first test Super Top Park in Centurion, South Africa came to a close with England leading an improbable 376 to win when bowled out for 268 just before tea at the bottom order offered vacant stand resistance to a barrage of pace once South Africa had taken the second new ball. And in basketball news, Al Ahly basketball player Soraya Mohammed was named among the 10 women who defined 3x3 FIBA basketball in 2019 by the Federation of International Basketball Association. Soraya Mohammed had an outstanding year as she won the FIBA 3x3 African Cup in November, with Egypt earning their victory over Mali. And that's Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, Paul, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good week. And that's it for this Monday, December 30th edition of Daybreak Africa. We look forward to spending the week with you. Join us again tomorrow for more Africa news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America as we count down the last days of 2019. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm Paul Alexander in Washington, wishing you will have a very good week.
Want to relax, unwind, or charge up? Then listen to Music Time in Africa this weekend. It'll do all that for you and more. I'm Heather Maxwell. I know good music. And Africa is my passion. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for 1 hour of commercial-free Pan-African music of the highest caliber. You get great music, music news, and amazing artist interviews from rising stars to superstars. This listen will take you places. So do it. Join me for Music Time in Africa, your weekend destination.